The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. With national attention and controversy over the new Common Core education standards, it's easy to forget that another school reform effort is still in place. No Child Left Behind. Signed in the early 2000s, NCLB was called the signature domestic achievement of President George W. Bush. It passed with bipartisan support. Still, many Republicans were uncomfortable with it, saying it established too large a role for the federal government in local public schools. Yet, NCLB has remained in effect, and Congress was supposed to reauthorize it in 2007. Now, just this month, the U.S. House and Senate finally got around to finishing the job. Each body has its own version, and a compromise committee is working on a final bill. Meanwhile, President Obama and his Education Secretary Arne Duncan have been hedging on how they feel. The White House wants to keep the law as federal oversight, while Congress wants to give much of that power back to the states. Today in The Exchange, a rewrite for No Child Left Behind and what it might mean for New Hampshire schools. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour with me in studio. Laura Haney, president of the American Federation of Teachers in New Hampshire. And Laura, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Also with us, Mary Erick, administrator of the Bureau of Integrated Programs for the New Hampshire Department of Education and state director of Title I. And Mary, welcome back to you, too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
And joining us from D.C., Allison Klein, reporter for Education Week on federal policy and programs, including No Child Left Behind. And Allison, thank you for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, Allison, I want to start with you with just a little background. Remind us how and why this came about, this effort by President Bush, which did, as I said, received bipartisan support.
So it was the No Child Left Behind Act was actually a long, long time in the making. In 1983, Washington put out a report called A Nation at Risk, which showed that the United States was slipping behind its competitors in terms of education, and that we were going to have a workforce that just wasn't as prepared as elsewhere in the world. So slowly states, led by governors, including future President Bill Clinton, began putting in place standards and assessments to try to see how to better track student learning and hold schools accountable. Texas, as probably most of you know, which was, you know, obviously future President Bush's state, also was a leader in that kind of early accountability movement. There was a bill once President Clinton came into office that told states that they had to have some tests in place, although not nearly as many tests as were required under No Child Left Behind. But when President Bush came into office, civil rights groups and business leaders rallied together. They said there needed to be annual testing and that states needed to break up the data to see how students were doing so that we could compare special needs kids and English language learners, racial minorities and disadvantaged kids to other kids. And schools were really charged with getting everybody prepared for college in the workforce, but also in closing the achievement gap. And it was this big bipartisan effort led by civil rights and the business community.
So we've had this this focus on standards and assessments and accountability for a long time, Allison.
Yeah, we have. The Standards and Accountability Movement is probably, really dates back to 1983. So that makes it, I guess, almost over 30 years old.
Well, I think some listeners might be surprised to hear that No Child Left Behind is even still in effect. We hear so much about Common Core, but there it is, NCLB, still on the books. How much is it still affecting what happens in American public schools, Allison?
That's a great question, because back in 2011, when it was clear that Congress was not going to pass a reauthorization of this bill, President Obama and his Education Secretary Arne Duncan gave states a chance to get out of some of the law's kind of toughest mandates by signing on for waivers. And waivers expected states to come up with sort of a brand new accountability system that included holding teachers accountable for student performance through test scores, signing on to rigorous standards, including the Common Core standards, and focusing their turnaround efforts on their lowest performing schools.
So you can do it your own way. You still have to meet certain goals, but you can do it your own way, states. That's what those waivers were all about.
Well, to some extent. They gave a lot more flexibility than No Child Left Behind, but not nearly as much flexibility as these bills that are making their way through Congress.
So I think I'll turn to you next, Mary Erick, but I want to hear from you too, Laura. How is No Child Left Behind still having an impact on New Hampshire schools? Because you hear almost nothing about it these days.
Well, the reason you're not hearing much about it is because we are a waiver state, and we have just put in for a renewal of our waiver. So we actually have not been held accountable to the historic NCLB regulations.
So we got a big waiver from the federal government. We said, you know, federal government, we promised to hold schools accountable, but we're going to do it our own way. Is that okay? They said yes. So mm-hmm. We've been doing it our own way for a couple years now.
Correct.
So is it having an impact on New Hampshire schools at all?
It has an impact on the schools that are not identified as the lowest performing. So if you're not a focus, a priority, or a SIG school, those schools have more regulations around what how they're being held accountable unless they adhere to the waiver system.
What's a SIG school?
So, those are schools in need of improvement as well.
Okay. So, Laura Haney, how is No Child Left Behind still affecting classrooms around the state? What do you see?
I see that the high-stakes testing and the amount of testing that's required under No Child Left Behind still continues through the race to the top and the waivers. And I think we need to get a handle on actually how much testing are we doing with these students. And if you look at the teachers' working environment is the students' working environment. So if the teachers are really stressed that they're being pushed into these tests and you have to do these tests and you have to do well, if you don't do well, you could be fired. I think we really need to take a step back and really look at that testing and what's going on that started back in No Child Left Behind.
So how much testing is there these days? I mean, we've heard about No Child Left Behind, and then there's the Common Core Smarter Balanced, and then there used to be what we called the NECAPS, the New England Common Assessment Program. So just remind us what goes on in the classroom right now,
there's
Laura.
There's a lot. If you're a classroom teacher, you look and you have the state test, you have your local test, but then you also have your in-class assessments that you're doing. And assessments can be used and should be given if we use the data in the correct way to improve instruction and to help students really learn and master the skills they're doing. But I think we've gotten away from that, and it's always been, let's do this test, and it's test and punishment. And let's go back.
Test and punish the teacher for not having good results.
Right. And let's go back, you know, and I don't think we have a good handle on how much testing is really going on in some of these schools. Every district does something different. And especially special ed kids, they seem to be tested all the time for reevaluations and all that stuff. But I think we do need to take that step back and really look at how much testing are we really doing.
Yeah, go ahead, Mary, and then I have another question for you, Allison. But go ahead, Mary.
An example of what's going on currently in the state would be Sanborn Regional, Rochester, Epping, and Sauhegan have been working with the New Hampshire Department of Education over the last 5 years to develop its own accountability system, which was approved by the federal government to move forward this year.
Accountability and less tests in those four districts.
Tests. And in fact, the focus of this is what is valuable, what is important, and what is meaningful.
And just give us a little bit more on that, Mary. So there has been this backlash against too much testing, and I'm going to ask Allison about that. But what's the proper balance then? You know, Department of Education obviously wants information about how state schools are doing, but it can get overwhelming, as Laura says.
That's why the Department of Education is working closely with school districts who are working closely with their constituents, so the educators in their districts, the school boards in their districts, to work collaboratively to identify what they feel the most valuable information is. The New Hampshire Department of Education does not require anything in addition to what the federal government does. Other states do.
That's where we've seen some of this backlash elsewhere. Allison, I read a big article a couple months ago about Florida. I think there have been, you know, public meetings and parents saying, you know, stop the testing. What's this backlash against testing? And how much does that stem, Allison, from No Child Left Behind?
Well, I think it stems both from No Child Left Behind, Common Core, and the teacher evaluation requirement that was in the waivers. So all of those things kind of came to a head at the same time last year. We had states trying out these new tests linked to the Common Core for the first time. I know New Hampshire is using Smarter Balanced. Some other states are using a test called PARC. But these tests are really different to some extent from what students are used to. In some cases, they're a lot more challenging than state assessments used to be. A lot of students were feeling frustrated, not doing well on the test. Teachers were being held accountable in terms of their evaluations for how their kids did on the test. And that just fueled this nationwide backlash against standardized testing.
Well, and a waiver then, Allison, doesn't mean, you know, you think, oh, good, we got a waiver from No Child Left Behind. Phew. But it doesn't mean less testing, it sounds like.
No, it's exactly the same amount of testing. And actually, arguably, the waivers made high-stakes testing even higher stakes because there were stakes in there for teachers and not just schools as there were under No Child Left Behind.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that, Allison. We often hear that phrase, high-stakes testing. What does that mean exactly?
So high-stakes testing would be any test that would determine, I guess, a rating or qualification for a school or for an educator. So there are a number of tests that are maybe just used diagnostically to figure out what students' strengths and weaknesses are. High-stakes tests are supposed to be used for accountability purposes, to say where a particular teacher or a particular school or even a particular student, where should they should go next. So, for instance, when a student enters higher education, they often have to take a placement test, and that could be high stakes for them because if they don't do well on that test, they could have to take remedial classes.
Okay, and so the pushback, Laura, from teachers has been if you're judged on the results of these tests, but if half the kids in your school, you know, they didn't have breakfast that morning, the parents were, you know, had them up late in the night, you know, who knows,
yeah.
You know, and then all of a sudden that's your fault.
Right, right. And if you look at that, the we don't test in every single subject. We don't have a high-stakes test for phys ed, for art. So you have to look at how do you make it fair and equitable for the teachers as well as the students moving forward. So if you're a English teacher or a reading teacher, that's one of the main tests on the Smarter Balance. Yes, we're going to see how you do in your language arts. But how does that affect the phys ed teacher? How does that affect the art teacher and the music teacher? And how do you bring it all together so that you bring that community of that school together, that everyone feels they're being treated equally and fair?
We are going to take a very short break. We're going to check in now with our summer car raffle. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the current congressional rewrite of the No Child Left Behind law. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Well over a decade since this Education Reform Act was signed by President Bush, we're looking at its impact on New Hampshire schools, how it's being rewritten right now by the U.S. House and Senate. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Laura Haney, president of the American Federation of Teachers in New Hampshire, Mary Erich, she's with the New Hampshire Department of Education, and joining us from D.C., Allison Klein, reporter for Education Week on federal policy. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Allison, before we talk about this rewrite and all the politics and all the details involved, I did want to just ask you what the difference between No Child Left Behind and the Common Core is. When we started out talking, you know, Common Core is kind of taking up all the oxygen in the room these days, but No Child Left Behind is still there. What's the difference between these two education reform efforts?
Sure. So No Child Left Behind is actually the name for a reauthorization or a rewrite of a law that dates back to 1965 called the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. It was part of President Johnson's Great Society program, and it basically gave the federal government a role in helping to finance education, particularly for the poorest students. Now, over the years, as we talked about before, the federal government added more and more accountability metrics to make sure that school districts and states were spending this money wisely. And they went definitely the furthest ever with No Child Left Behind, which is what required those tests that we always hear about. Those tests are given in reading and math in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school, and also in science in certain grades. So that's No Child Left Behind. The Common Core didn't get started until around 2009, 2010, when the Council of Chief State School Officers, which represents all of the state education agencies like the New Hampshire Department of Education in every state, and the National Governors Association came together to say basically that the United States needed to have more uniform standards so that the standards don't look so different between, say, Massachusetts and Mississippi, and that those standards needed to really get kids ready for college and the workforce. That really needed to be the bar, going to college without needing any sort of remediation, without having to take really basic classes that you could start right away in credits in courses that would allow you to earn college credit. So they worked together to design the Common Core standards. Most states, originally 46 states, signed on, and the District of Columbia signed on to those standards. But then we began to see more and more pushback, particularly as the Obama administration kind of embraced and some would say took credit for the Common Core.
Yeah, and I did want to ask you that. You know, as you said, this was an effort that started in the states by the leading education officers in those states, and then states could decide to sign on to or not. Most of them did, as you said. But Common Core is often associated with, you know, what critics call a federal overreach, the federal government getting too involved. Some people call it Obama Core. But it did start with the states. So why are the two blended when they didn't start in the same place?
So that is a great question. President Obama got a ton of money when he first came into office for education, $100 billion through the stimulus. And he used a piece of that money for a program called Race to the Top, which basically offered cash rewards to states that were willing to embrace education reform priorities that the administration agreed with. We talked about teacher evaluation already, but also on standards. So these states needed to have college and career-ready standards that were common to a significant number of states. That's what the law said. Or I'm sorry, that's how the program defined it. But Common Core was the only set of standards that counted. So basically, Race to the Top rewarded states for signing on to Common Core. And then with the waivers, which came around a little later in 2011, states were required to have college and career-ready standards. If they went with the Common Core, they were done, perfect, you've got your college and career-ready standards in place. If you decided not to go with Common Core, you could still use your own standards, but you had to have your institutions of higher education say, you know, these standards are rigorous enough to get kids ready for college and career. And a few states, like Virginia, went that route without a problem. But it was sort of seen as additional coercion for the Common Core.
So go ahead, Allison.
Tests, yeah. Those tests that we talk about, Smarter, Balanced, and PARC, that are linked to the Common Core standards, they were funded with federal stimulus money. So that's another reason that people conflate the Common Core with President Obama.
Well, and this may be the most basic question in the world, but I'll ask you anyway, Mary. If we had the testing regime in place from No Child Left Behind, and then many states, including New Hampshire, signed on to Common Core, so that's a whole different set of assessments and tests. Why do we need both?
In New Hampshire, we have college and career readiness standards, so I think that needs to be stated clearly. We have not signed on, nor do we hold anyone accountable to the Common Core. Local school boards and school districts can choose to adopt those standards, but it's one of a menu of standards.
So that's a local decision.
Yes.
Whether to sign on to that Smarter Balanced test, which is associated with Common Core.
That's not what you asked me. It's a local decision whether or not to align your standards to the Common Core. Right now, we have the Smarter Balanced testing, which someone can use as the requirement. But as I explained to you with the PACE project, districts are beginning to work with the New Hampshire DOE to say that we have alternate ways of looking at this, and the Department of Education is working with them closely to move those agendas forward.
So that's four districts so far. So
At the moment, we had to go through the federal government to have that approved. It was. And the reauthorization is so exciting because if it moves through, it would allow us much greater flexibility with projects such as that.
All right. Let's go to our listeners. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Today in the exchange, we're sorting out this reauthorization, this rewrite of No Child Left Behind, signed more than a decade ago under the Bush administration, how that fits in with some other reform efforts underway. Let's go to Nashua first, where Deb is on the line. Hi, Deb. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Good morning. I'm a teacher in Nashua, and I wanted to call to just talk a little bit about what testing really looks like from the teacher's perspective in the classroom. We talk about one high-stakes test a year, and what that means is we've got the Smarter Balance test, which is taken every grade, grades 3 through 8, and in grade 11, and then the students also spend time practicing to take that test, because they need to know how to use the computers to answer the questions. So it's not a question of whether they knew what to do to indicate the answer. You want to know what they know. So that's some more time dedicated to it. They also have, we use some of the released materials to help prepare them for the sorts of questions that are going to come up so that they can think the way the test makers want them to think. We have another test called iReady, which is used for placement and leveling. But we do that particular test two or three times a year, so they'll be ready for that Smarter Balance test. And on top of that, we have science kneecaps. We have NAEP testing, which is another national test for the national report card. And then we have all our local tests. That's a lot of testing the kids are getting.
Wow.
It's not just one test a year. Yeah.
When do you eat lunch, Deb?
When do we eat lunch, exactly? Well, what this leads to is it means we spend so much time and there's so much pressure to perform on these tests that we're really taking the joy out of education. It means that when a student gets interested in something, and those are always the most powerful learning moments, when a student just wonders about something, or they've seen something or read something or they've observed something outdoors in real life, you can't go with them and explore that and just take the time to follow where their wonder is leading you. You've got to be preparing for the next test.
Well, and Deb, I've heard that critique. Let me ask you a question from the other side, if I could, please, since you're a classroom teacher and it's good to hear from you. So from a parent's perspective, we want to know how the schools are doing. Are they teaching our kids what they need to know to be successful in life? So what's the balance between, as you put it, sucking the joy out of learning and, letting parents and taxpayers know that the schools are doing their job?
The balance, you need to show what students can do. But one test that you are doing several practices and other tests to prepare for, that's way too much testing. I think you need to get back to actually having end of unit or end of semester assessments that align to real world tasks. So if you want to know if children can add and subtract, maybe you have them add up a grocery bill or do a budget or something like that that would mirror a task you'd like to be able to see kids do.
In real life.
Instead of having one standardized test.
Let me ask you one last quick question. Again, from your perspective as a classroom teacher, the big goal of No Child Left Behind was to, obviously, improve American public education. More than a decade later, has it met that goal? What do you think, Deb?
I think it has not met that goal. I think it has created a lot of stress on teachers and on school districts. And they're spending so much time trying to find the magic bullet to raise the test score that they're losing sight of the students.
Okay. Thank you for calling in, Deb. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Laura Haney, how would you answer that question? If the big goal of NCLB is to make public schools better, has it been a net positive for public education?
I don't believe so.
It's been more than a decade, yeah, so we yeah. should be able to know by now.
I don't think it has. I believe that No Child Left Behind was put in to punish instead of making schools better. They wanted, you know, part of that law was if the school wasn't succeeding, you close it down completely and start all over new, fire, you know, the staff, get a new principal. So I don't think the bill truly was written to make to gain success. I just think it was there to let's punish and let's see who we can point the finger at this time.
Why would the drafters do that?
I'm not sure. This is my belief. I don't have any data to say that yes, I can point to it right here. But I think it's added some undue stress on everyone, especially the students, having to sit there and to take those tests and look at to do that stuff. It's draining on those students. I can remember one of my students was so frustrated at the time. It was a paper pencil test. He wrapped it up in tape and threw it. He was just so frustrated with the whole thing, and I don't blame him. And he was a very, very bright kid. But to have him sit down and, you know, for 30 minutes, 45 minutes and take a test, he just couldn't do it. But if I could get him out in the yard and do gardening or to work on a car, it was just amazing what this child could do.
That talks to the flexibility that our caller mentioned. Allison, how about you? I mean, what are people saying, 12, 13, 14 years after No Child Left Behind? Are people saying in Washington that, with all the data now and with all these years behind us, this has improved American public education or not?
So I think that the number one thing that people credit No Child Left Behind with was this focus on the achievement gap. This was sort of the first major effort to ensure that every single school broke out data by subgroups, by racial, including showing how racial minorities, disadvantaged kids, English language learners, students in special education were doing relative to kids who had traditionally been more advantaged. So there were a number of schools that their data might look great overall, but they were leaving certain populations within the school behind. And No Child Left Behind shined a light on those campuses and pushed them to improve. Now, what critics say, and there's definitely a strong argument here, is that all it sort of did was, I guess, measure something over and over and over again and just expect that by measuring it, it would automatically get better. No Child Left Behind it was supposed to come with a lot more federal money, and that's just never been realized.
The idea that there wasn't enough resources attached to make this happen. And Mira, get your thoughts on that too. After a very quick break, we're going to check in now with our summer car raffle. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at No Child Left Behind, the federal education reform law from more than a decade ago, and how this law is currently being reauthorized by Congress, how it's affecting New Hampshire schools. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Allison Klein joins us from D.C. She's a reporter for Education Week following federal policy. Laura Haney with the American Federation of Teachers in New Hampshire. And Mary Erick, administrator of the Bureau for Integrated Programs at the New Hampshire Department of Education. And Mary, before we go back to our listeners, I did want to let you take a crack at that big question that we talked about before the break. If the goal of No Child Left Behind was to improve American public education more than a decade later, has it met that goal?
I think the reauthorization is a direct outcome that NCLB, although with good intentions and with many architects of that bill that hoped that equity pedagogies would move forward, it was an unfunded mandate, meaning the funding was not there to give the supports necessary for NCLB to be fully implemented. So the reauthorization is an opportunity for states such as New Hampshire, who have been looking at innovations and how to move forward more collaborative ways, working closely with districts and the community, to be able to do that, since the reauthorization would really allow for a lot more flexibility in the use of funds and a lot more state control.
So you sound excited about the prospects of this reauthorization, that it will make it better.
Well, specifically in some of the pieces of the reauthorization that's being moving forward, they're asking states to look at accountability systems and say, are we over-testing? are there tests that are not necessary? I mean, allowing states to engage in those conversations aligns with the goals that we have currently in the initiatives that we're moving forward.
When people talk about accountability, is there anything in this proposed rewrite, and I should say rewrites, because the House has its version and the Senate has its version, is there anything about district accountability, federal accountability? Like you said, Mary, that NCLB was hard for districts to implement because they didn't have the resources. Is there anything about accountability, not having to do with the teachers, but with other entities, the district, the superintendent, the federal government, parents, you know, all the other people that are involved in this, instead of just putting all the accountability piece on the teachers?
What they're shifting to with this is that states can develop those systems. And since our state works on a task force basis, Commissioner Berry has been integral in ensuring that task force with the community leaders come together to make these joint decisions. The reauthorization would allow us to reevaluate those systems.
All right. Do you want to jump in on that too, Laura Haney, this whole idea of accountability? It's kind of a loaded term.
Yeah, and I think you brought up a great point. Where is the accountability for the federal account, you know? They are supposed to fund this stuff. They're supposed to give us some support, and they haven't done that. So I think it's a great thing, and we need to start looking at that. There is one part in the Senate bill that I think needs to be looked at is doing some kind of assessment or a survey within the school and what's happening in the school, what's the environment like. So not just looking at, you know, the testing, but let's look at the school as a whole. Is the principal really out there? And can you speak to the principal? You know, do they have a good parent-teacher relationship? So I think doing that survey and collecting some of this data may send some good signals to some of these schools. Hey, we need to do a better job at this. Let's spend some of our time, you know, making sure that we bring the parents in more and to help them help the students at home.
Well, and here's an email from Josh on that point. He says, I'm a high school public teacher in northern New Hampshire. Laura asked the last caller how parents and taxpayers can know schools are doing what they're supposed to be doing if there is not a test to, quote unquote, prove it. He says, great question. Here's the answer. Parents and taxpayers should be invited into the classroom anytime they want. We as teachers use or should be using digital classroom software like Google Classroom, Edmodo, Schoolology, etc. All parents should have access to the digital classroom their child is using so they can actually see the work their child is doing and, more importantly, the progress they're making. Josh says a single test score or a grade is a placeholder, not actual information about learning. Seeing the process is the proof, he says, and can see it from the comfort of your own home or office, from your personal computer, smartphone, or tablet. Josh, good to hear from you. What do you think about that, Allison, the idea that there are a lot of resources for parents these days to keep track, even if they can't make time out for that, you know, old-fashioned parent-teacher conference?
So I think that's a really good point, that technology has made it easier for parents to see how their student is doing in school. So for really informed parents, maybe the tests are a little bit less necessary. What some advocates would say is, you know, having those yearly statewide tests really keeps schools honest and holds them accountable for kids whose parents may be a little bit less involved, those traditionally disadvantaged populations that I talked about earlier.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Josh, thanks for that email. Let's go to a call from Portsmouth. Ori's on the line. Hi, Ori. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
That's a tough question to follow up there. I'm just calling. I'm wondering if there's any conversation about having more of a multivariate longitudinal way of evaluating schools' performance. It seems like we have these kind of systems in place to get data over time, but we're kind of focusing on one issue for funding, which is just like short-term memorization on the place of students, which is great for, you know, measuring individual teachers, but doesn't necessarily measure the school overall.
You know, this is exactly what you've been hitting on a couple times, Mary, that New Hampshire in particular is looking at this more meaningful way to assess progress.
Yes, that is true. That's why we have several projects. We have another project in the state called SWIFT, which is a school-wide integrated framework for transformation. It's a year-long technical assistance project that schools can apply on a rolling basis to engage in. And it looks at schools from a very holistic perspective and assists them in thinking through how they want to communicate success and then using that to justify use of their federal funds.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call, Ori. And Allison, we keep talking about this reauthorization. I did want to dig into this a little bit more with you. Give us a preview, if you could, Allison. What are some of the key issues at play as negotiators from the U.S. House and Senate sit down to hammer out a final No Child Left Behind law? What are some of the biggies?
So the issue that's probably number one, and it's dominated our conversation this morning, is accountability. The White House and the Department of Education are worried that both the House and Senate bill, and I think they're especially concerned about the House bill, but they're worried about the Senate bill too, just don't contain enough protections for those disadvantaged populations that I talked about and for the lowest performing schools. Both of the bills don't have any requirement that states turn around a specific number of schools or that states take control of school turnarounds. And they don't have any really specific requirement that states and districts intervene in schools with really big achievement gaps. And that's something that the administration would really like to see. Beyond that, there are some kind of wonky in the weeds type issues that are also going to be a really big deal. For instance, the House bill would allow Title I money, that's federal money that's given to schools with a lot of poor kids, to follow students to the public school of their parents' choice. And that's something that's not in the Senate bill. It's a big deal. And then also the Senate bill would change the Title I funding formula, which right now gears a lot of money to areas with a lot of population density. So states like New York and Pennsylvania and Maryland would lose out under this change, but New Hampshire actually would gain. So those are three of the biggest issues to watch.
So what measures there are in place to make sure lower performing students are not, quote unquote, left behind? And that was the big goal, right, Allison, of No Child Left Behind? And then what level of federal intervention is okay? Those are going to be some of the big sticking points here between the White House and Congress?
Yes, I would say those are the sticking points between the White House and Congress. And those other two sort of funding issues I brought up are differences between the House bill and the Senate bill.
And from what I understand from your reporting, Allison, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and several large civil rights groups representing African Americans, Mexican Americans, they're kind of siding with the president and Arne Duncan on this, right? They want more federal oversight and control. And then on the other side, you've got Republicans and lots of local district people saying, we don't want the federal government involved in this. Is that correct?
Yes, that's exactly right. I mentioned earlier that civil rights and business leaders were among the biggest cheerleaders of No Child Left Behind when it passed back in 2001. And those folks are continuing to champion this strong federal accountability for poor and minority students. And I think what teachers and school administrators are saying is, hey, we understand why you're concerned about those students. We're concerned about them, too. You really need to trust us to do what's right by them. This testing regime just really hasn't worked. It hasn't improved outcomes for anyone.
All right. Well, Allison, we've got links on our website to your work on No Child Left Behind and federal involvement in public education. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Allison Klein, reporter for Education Week. And Laura Haney, Mary Erick, thank you also very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is The Exchange on NHPR, checking in now with our summer car raffle.